could be punished. Many of the Twitter messages are official statements by North Korea. One said, "Great leader Kim Jong-il watched a performance while traveling the country with soldiers." For NPR News, I'm Duah Lee, Sai Kowtow in Seoul.
Police in South Africa have used rubber bullets to break up a group of striking teachers protesting in Johannesburg. The teachers are part of a larger group of striking civil servants. They're demanding the South African government pay them higher wages. Computer chip maker Intel says it wants to buy security technology firm McAfee Incorporated. The purchase price is well over $7.5 billion. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to improve the safety of the nation's food supply at pewtrusts.org/food safety.
Support for WILL comes from the College Illinois 529 prepaid tuition program, the tax-advantaged plan that shields families from tuition inflation by allowing them to lock in prices now at colleges. More information can be found at 529prepaidtuition.org. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. This Saturday's wine tasting will be in their new space and features Lisa Gustafson presenting a lineup of wines from Heritage Wine Cellars. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives. So as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. When he climbed into the Spirit of St. Louis and took off from New York in May of 1927, very few people knew who Charles Lindbergh was. When he touched down 33 hours later on the other side of the Atlantic, he was on his way to becoming the most famous celebrity of his day. Also, his transatlantic flight got a lot of people thinking about the potential profits that could be generated by aviation. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Thomas Kessner about his new book, which is titled The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation. It's published by the Oxford University Press. It's just come out, and indeed it explores not only Charles Lindbergh, his life, his flight, but his role in promoting the airline industry, and then, of course, the many ways that that industry went on to change the way that we live. Our guest, Thomas Kessner, is Distinguished Professor of History at the City University of New York Graduate Center, and he's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about his book and about Charles Lindbergh. And Professor Kessner, hello.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay, doing
good.
Well.
Good. Thanks for talking with us. I think that now that transatlantic flight is commonplace, and in fact, human beings have flown in space, we've been to the moon and back, I suppose now it's hard to recapture how people would have thought about and felt about this first transatlantic flight.
Yeah, I mean, That's very true. We are so used to the idea of the flight, not only flying in the air and staying in the air and what you've mentioned, but also the notion that this is so routine, that there's very little danger, that it's become something that's an everyday kind of occurrence. It was very different in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm. And it just when you read about the plane and what it was like and the circumstances, and you don't have to think very long about just how difficult and just how dangerous this flight was.
Yeah, the thing that we have to keep in mind is that massive, huge airplanes had been built which tried to do this and crashed. People who had wonderful reputations from flying in World War I in combat, tried to do the flight, and six of them perished. Here was somebody who was coming in a plane that measured no taller than 10 feet tall, weighed less than a ton and a half, and was going to try to make it across the ocean. This plane was going to cost, minus the motor, about $6,000. The plane that one of the competitors built cost well over $100,000 and built by the great manufacturer Sikorsky. Mm-hmm. It was something that almost nobody paid attention to until Lindbergh actually came to New York, just because it seemed like such an impossibility.
Yeah, and it's not if one has a chance to see it. Certainly, the Spirit of St. Louis. It's not a, as you say, it's not a very big plane. Essentially is a flying gas tank because you needed a lot of fuel to get there, and there's no direct way to look out of the plane. That is, it doesn't have a windshield. You can't look out of the plane, out of the front of the plane, and see where it is that you're going.
Right. The front vision was obstructed by a huge fuel tank because they had to put five different fuel tanks around this tiny little plane to carry the 450 gallons of fuel that would get them across the ocean. There was no unobstructed vision, and more to the point, I guess, for people like us who are so used to the idea of constantly being in touch and in contact, there was no radio contact. He was going to go and disappear from not only from view but also from any contact, any communication with people here in the United States or anywhere else in the world, no ship communication, no way that he would be able to tell them what was happening or to get information.
So how did he know where he was going?
He had his navigational tools. He figured out how, he taught himself how to navigate, and he had his maps, and that was as much as he had with him. Mm. In fact, those maps, in order to conserve on as much room, on as much weight as he could, because weight translated into more fuel, and the one thing that was special about the Lindbergh flight is that he differed in theory from all the others. They thought that they would make big planes, strap on extra motors, and that would be the margin of safety. He argued that it was just the opposite. He'd make as tiny a plane as possible, keep it a single-engine plane, keep weight down, and that was the safest way to get across the ocean. He made it. They didn't.
Yeah, I suppose some people would say that would have been an extraordinary gamble. If, for example, if something went wrong with his engine, if he had a problem there, he only had one engine, so that that would have been it.
You're absolutely right. And the other extraordinary thing is that he only had one person on the plane. Everybody else was going with at least two, some went with four, so that there could be relief. There could be somebody who was a navigational expert, somebody who was a communications expert, someone who could fix things in the midst of the flight so that there was a mechanic with the others. He went alone, and that meant that he could not, for more than 2 or 3 seconds, he could not take his attention off of what he was doing. If he did, the only thing that faced him was death.
So that was, and that meant he had to go 36 hours without a break.
Absolutely. And in fact, he ended up going 60 hours without a break because he was not able to catch any sleep the night before. And he had gone for the day before without any sleep, so that he ended up ultimately going for about 60, 62 hours without any sleep.
Yeah. When you think about this, you start thinking that either this was a man who was extraordinarily brave or extraordinarily foolhardy.
Yeah, a bit of both, I guess. It's absolutely true that everybody else is telling him that this was a fool's errand. And he believed in his calculations. He believed in the theory that a small plane with enough fuel would get him across. The one thing he did not anticipate was how tired he would get. The single most dangerous aspect of the flight was the fact that he constantly had to be fighting off this terribly powerful somnolence, the eyes drooping, and the entire weight of sleep deprivation, that he had a constant battle with it throughout the flight.
I don't know how much bigger a plane it would have had to be, how much bigger, how much heavier, how much more fuel it would have had to be, say, if he had a co-pilot, if there was one other person with him. Was that something that he ever considered?
Well, everybody else was considering it. He shocked Donald Hall, who was the engineer who helped design and build the plane, when he went out to San Diego. And Donald Hall asked him, okay, so now these are the specifications that you have. So how do we set up the second seat? And he said, there is no second seat, and I'm going alone. And Hall just looked at him. It would have meant, probably at least 50 more gallons of fuel, maybe a bit more. The problem, as he saw it, was that the major reason that the three other planes that tried it within weeks before him, the reason that they didn't succeed was because they had been overloaded. One of them was a 10-ton behemoth. The others were really heavy. One of them that went from France was not, but it was not. It was well over 4 tons. He was going to go with a 1-ton plane. This was the one thing that he was absolutely obsessed about. He cut everything. He would not take more than 4 sandwiches. He took a minimal amount of water. He threw away his emergency equipment. He would take no radio. He cut down on the instruments that he was using. He was absolutely obsessive about cutting as much as he could. He would take no mail for anybody. You know, people wanted to make some money off of sending something across the ocean and being aboard the first plane that made it to Paris, and they were offering him thousands, but he refused to do that. He was obsessive about cutting down on the weight.
Our guest in this hour focus is Thomas Kestner. He is Distinguished Professor of History at the City University of New York Graduate Center and is the author of the recent book, The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation. It's about Lindbergh and his life and his flight and also about what that meant for American aviation. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Out now. Questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You do look at the book, in the book at his life and his growing up. Tell us a little bit about his childhood.
He grew up in Midwest, in Minnesota. He was born to a well-off family, but soon after he was born, his father suffered reverses. His father, and this was a second marriage, his father had lost his first wife. And Charles Lindbergh was born in 1902 to Charles A. Lindbergh, his father. It was not a true senior because there was a slight difference in the way they spelled their names, the middle name. And his father had married a younger woman from Detroit, Evangeline Land. That marriage lasted in happiness for about a year and a half, 2 years, but it was very difficult for Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh's mother, to get used to living out west. And with the reverses that the family underwent, plus the fact that their home burned down, they became a very different type of family. In fact, this family became entirely dysfunctional. His father would go off to Congress, and the father and mother separated very early, and he was essentially raised by his mother. His father had a presence in his life because his mother was interested in keeping her husband there, and in those days they wanted as much as possible to avoid divorce, but he was largely raised by his mother, and the thing that most concerned his father was that he should be able to cut him off from his mother's apron strings. Charles Lindbergh, from the age of 12, protected his mother, drove her around. He was driving a car at the age of 12 and a half. He was a loner. He loved solitude, and a recent book I've seen even suggested that he might have suffered from Asperger's because of the intense concentration that he placed on individual items which he would concentrate on enormously well, like planning a flight, like planning his every step along the way in his life, and that this may have had something to do with the way that he was raised. But he, in terms of school, he was a disaster. He went to 12 different schools. He was at the bottom or close to the bottom of every one of the classes that he was in. Ultimately, he was accepted to University of Wisconsin, where he flunked out. And it looked like he was not going to do too well and that there was not much of a future for him until his parents allowed him to do what it is that he wanted very much to do, and that is to join that small group of people who were involved in flight.
Yeah. It seems that from a fairly young age, you could almost see, and I don't know, maybe this is the virtue of hindsight, but you could almost see him set on the course that he was going to take. And you can see in some aspects of his personality also the way that he went about it. So that then, again, if you go to the some of the things we were talking about at the beginning about this flight and why he did it the way he did and why he was determined to go it alone, you could say, well, yes, he said that he thought the reason that people who had tried this before and not succeeded was, you know, that there were technical reasons. The planes were too big. There was too much weight. So that's why he decided small plane, he was going to do it by himself. But then, you know, you look at some aspects of his personality and maybe you also say, well, I can see maybe why he decided he was that was the kind of guy that he was. So maybe it was as much an expression of his personality or his inclination as it was his idea about what technical aspects of this project would be most likely to guarantee success.
David, you're absolutely right. His father had told him once, one boy is a boy, two boys is half a boy, three boys is no boy at all. He didn't want two, three, four opinions. He didn't want to have to answer to anybody. One of the flights that ultimately did not make it ahead of him fell apart because of internal division, because of dissension within. This was something he avoided because he was insisting on doing it alone. And as you say, it may very well have been not so much a function of his wise analysis of what went wrong with the others as much as his personality. He needed to do it alone. In fact, the fact that he did it alone set it apart from all the other flights. And that had a lot to do with making it so extraordinary and why it captured the imagination of the American people. When Calvin Coolidge, the President of the United States, welcomed him back to Washington, one of the closing points of his welcoming speech was, and he did it alone. I mean, this was so American, so individualistic, and so much in line with the times, with the idea of individual still having some sort of importance in this emerging machine age, that it had a lot to do with the way that he captivated the American population and the rest of the world.
Well, and you can also see how appealing an image that would be for popular media at the time, the lone eagle kind of thing. It's just, I'm sure that was just irresistible for people who wanted to write about him.
Absolutely, and that helped make him into the celebrity that he became. I mean, he was the single best publicized and best known celebrity in world history to that point.
And also, though he was, isn't it also the case that he, you might actually say that he was painfully shy as an individual, and if indeed he was the kind of person that that you describe, you would think that that kind of fame might sit a little uneasily on him.
He was exactly what you say, painfully shy, a person who was not comfortable with this sort of fame, hated the idea that people would grab at him. Mentioned many times that he was so uncomfortable when women came over and introduced their children or wanted his autograph. This was something that was so alien to the way that he was brought up in the Midwest. And the celebrity was a painful kind of thing for him. I mean, ultimately, he blamed it for the tragedy of his son's kidnapping. But he, as you say, even before then, this dealing with the notion that the American public, and especially the tabloid newspapers, could intrude into his life and make it into everyday fare, this was something that he hated. Hmm.
We have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation, someone who's listening in Indiana on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. I would like for you to straighten out some memories here. When I was a youngster in Indiana, we got to see Lindbergh's, I don't know how many times we got to see that film, you know, over and over and over again. And I remember it being sort of a hero to us youngsters and things like that. Then, of course, there was the kidnapping. But I think also there's a balancing act in terms of his political views after the hero worship sort of died off. Now, there was a darker side to Lindbergh that people don't often talk about, and I was just wondering if you talk about it in your book or whether or not that gets dropped, particularly his relationships to Jews and some other groups later on in life when he had really had power to do things because of the financial situation he had at that time. Or if you'd speak to that, I'd like to get that cleared up in my mind. I mean, there's no getting away from the thing that he did. But the problem comes in the, you know, the social thing when somebody's venerated but, you know, has feet of clay, really. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, and that certainly, it was not something that I was intending to avoid.
Yeah.
Here's another big part of his story, that after having become this hero, this international celebrity for what he did, and later in life, and maybe it was not all that much later, he became a very controversial figure for his political views, particularly some of the things that he said in support of the Nazi regime in Germany.
Right. Absolutely correct. And I mean, that's part of the larger question of how we choose our heroes and what becomes of them and what about character and personality. Lindbergh was riding high in a hero in the United States from 1927 through the kidnapping. But by the mid-30s, the entire character of the nation had changed. In 1927, the United States itself was flying high. The economy was prosperous. Everything was developing. And the airline industry took off within a year and a half after this flight in an amazing way. And that's part of what we talk about, what I talk about in the book. But what happened subsequently with the Depression and with the kidnapping was not only that Lindbergh himself became very negative and very pessimistic about the United States. It threw his young wife into a depression. And by that time, a number of things had come out that tarnished a little bit the Lindbergh legacy, particularly what Cole was talking about in terms of finances, and I'll get back to that in a second. But the point is that in 1935, in December, right after Christmas time, Lindbergh and his wife left the country. And it did not leave a great impression that in the midst of this depression, when a man like Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who had fought polio and took from that the enormous power to give courage and strength to the American people, what they want to know did Lindbergh take from his flight and from his heroism, and what did he share with the American people? Instead, what he did was he retreated into his own tragedy, spoke very, very despairingly about democracy and about what free press could do, and turned his back on the American people and went to Europe. Of course, subsequently, his flirtation with Nazism, and then when he returned back to the United States 5 years later and became the prime speaker of the American First Movement, fighting against American entry into the war, arguing on the basis of racial grounds that the United States had more to do, had a more proper alignment with Germany than it did fighting Germany, that England and France were much too weak for us to side with them. What we must do is side with Germany and fight against Russia, fight against Japan, fight against the inferior races, essentially adopting this racial attitude. It became a very different Lindbergh, a Lindbergh whose heroism for one cause, that is to say for the flight and for the courage of the flight, was now tested by the fact that he expressed very openly his disdain for democracy and his affection for totalitarianism. Mm.
And how do you understand that? I mean, or is it possible to again sort of look at his life and his formative years and what you can know about him that would explain all of that?
Well, you were right before, and I think if we take the thread of your of what you had mentioned before and carry it a little bit further in terms of his personality, he was very much a regimented person. He could not deal with disorder. His wife laughed about the fact that when they prepared for a trip that they had to make, and again, he had to worry about how much he could take on the trip, it took him a month. He would make two piles in the living room, one for her, one for him. They had exactly the amount of weight that they would take. It would be and then he would be struggling over the course of the next few weeks to decide what was more important and weighing which one he would take and what he would not take and so forth. He was extremely regimented. He had lists when he went off on to do the flight to Paris. He had a list about what it is that he needed to prepare. He had another list of how he was going to raise the money, another list of what it is that he needed to do to get the necessary news coverage. Everything was on the list so that was his priority. He was going to take care of that. Till then, he never went out, never dated, never paid attention to the idea of women or co-eds in college. When he came back, he decided he was going to get married. He created another list. What was it that he was looking for? This kind of regimented, very strict kind of almost Prussian sense of how you involve yourself with the world was something that he found echoed in the way that Germany was developing under the Nazis. He had enormous blind spots, and one of them was that he was blind, essentially entirely blind to the mistreatment of the various groups in Germany, to the mistreatment of the Jews particularly. He paid no attention to that. He was far more impressed by the fact that their streets were clean, the government was well run, their air force was top flight. These were the things that impressed him. It may also have a lot to do with the very point that we talked about before about him going it alone before, when he took his plane alone and his living in solitude. He felt that the United States had become too much of a society in which groups were making decisions, and especially he did not like the drift of the New Deal that was moving in a direction that he considered socialist. He felt that the preservation of the individual and the focus on the individual, the kind of thing that early flyers had paid enormous attention to, that is to say that the individual heroism and the individual under stress and being able to succeed under stress, that this kind of triumph of the will was something that was celebrated in Nazi Germany and something that he felt very close to.
Let me introduce again, just very quickly, our guest, Thomas Kestner. He's Distinguished Professor of History at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He's the author of a number of books, including Fiorello H. LaGuardia and the Making of Modern New York, which was a New York Times notable book, and his most recent, then that's the one to look at if you're interested in reading some more about Charles Lindbergh. His most recent book is The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation. It is published by the Oxford University Press. I want to talk a little bit about the other big part of the story and ask you to talk about, at the time of Lindbergh's flight, what was the state of commercial aviation in the United States?
The state of commercial aviation in the United States was virtually non-existent. What happened during World War I, which was a huge stimulus to aviation in general, because this was the first war in which planes were used offensively, was that the nations that were involved in the war built up their air forces. The United States came to this quite late, but ultimately committed well over $1 billion to building an air force. The Air Force was built quickly. It was riddled with all kinds of shoddy work. But ultimately, there was this Air Force that emerged after World War I. The other nations, that is to say the European nations, considering that the possibility existed that war would break out again, spent a lot of federal, that is to say a lot of government money, to keep their airlines up to date and on airline on aviation research, building airports, doing all the things necessary to take aviation to the next level, that is to build a commercial aviation system. And it would be like it was in the old days. That is that in the old days when you had a maritime system, during war you were able to use the ships for battle, and then once the war was over you went back to civilian commercial use of the ships. And that was the same way that they would approach the airline industry. Here in the United States, Congress had no stomach for it. There were a number of investigations about the shoddiness of the work that was done during the war, about how money had been misused. And for that and a variety of other reasons, including, of course, the fact that this is a free enterprise economy where subsidies were not the common way of doing things, the airline industry in the United States was allowed to die, literally die. The emergency use of automobile factories to make airplanes during the war. Those factories went back to making automobiles. The others that had developed just simply closed their doors because there was no money coming through. The only thing that kept commercial aviation going in the United States was the Postal Service, because in 1918, the Postal Service began to use airplanes for airmail. And throughout that period, that is to say from 1918 to about 1924, the Postal Service continued to use aircraft. The aircraft was largely the obsolete aircraft that were built before, but there was still the need to service it, the need to replace engines, and so that the thread of commercial development in the United States was carried forward by the Postal Service. But until 1926, 27, until the eve of the flight by Lindbergh, American commercial aviation was behind virtually every of one of the countries that had any airline or any commercial aviation.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure at the time that Lindbergh did what he did, that there were people who were at least thinking about the potential and the potential profits for the possibility of taking mail, at least, being able to fly mail from the United States to Europe. And I don't know how many people actually made the leap to thinking about cargo and maybe thinking about passengers. That might have just been too much. But at least the idea that if we could have reliable mail service, there would be a lot of money to be made there. I'm sure also, though, they would have looked at Lindbergh and said, well, this is kind of a one-off. I mean, he did it, and he managed to live and tell the tale. But it's still very dangerous, very risky, and the idea of having an actually reliable sort of service by that way, you know, that's a big leap. Were there, in fact, though, people who looked at what Lindbergh did and said, see, now he showed that we can do it. If we can just take it from there, we have the potential here to make a lot of money.
Yeah, that's exactly the influence that the wide influence that his flight had. It was not unusual to see people fly a plane by 1927, but they did it as part of barnstorming, as part of putting on exhibits and shows. It was a sport. It was done for fun. It was done for thrill seekers. Was it serious? Could it carry something more in terms of its influence on the economy, its influence on trade, its influence on the way diplomacy was done, its influence on bringing the world closer together? Could it do that much more? The reason Lindbergh's flight meant so much for the United States in particular was because it demonstrated that, yes, it could. It should be taken seriously. As early as 1912, Scientific American ran an article talking about what the next level with regard to flight was. What would take it away from sport and make it something serious? And the article focused on transatlantic flight. That would prove that this was serious. That would prove that this could actually do what was promised by those who had been the kind of air visionaries, and that was that it would make the trip between one side of the ocean and the other something more regular, something that you you didn't have to worry about the storms, about bad weather, about being delayed by ships being delayed and all the rest, but rather that you could make it something much more common. And in fact, there was this large notion of the possibility. It was very much like, some people might remember the early days of the Internet, the notion that somehow the world could be crunched by technology. And that was the kind of notion that Lindbergh's flight very much tied into, as people thought that if it's possible, we could go over borders, we can bring nations closer together, we can do trade in ways that was never done before. And yes, to answer your question directly, it influenced it enormously because it made it regular and not a sport.
And were there people who were strenuously arguing that this was something that the United States government really needed to be involved in, and not just promoting for defense purposes, but for all, promoting as a kind of economic stimulus as a sort of a key thing that it was important for economic development?
Well, in terms of the defense, Billy Mitchell, famous general who was ultimately court-martialed because he took on the military mainstream, who still wanted to fight wars on the basis of battleships, and he kept arguing that, no, now that we're in a new air age, we've got to move into air defense. So that was one part of it, and that was the idea of using airplanes for defense. The other part of it, you're absolutely right. By 1925 and 1925-26, the President of the United States, Calvin Coolidge, realized that after 5 years of complaints from various people in the aviation industry, from those who looked at Europe and said, look, we're way behind, from those, many of the newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others, from 1921 on, had been suggesting that it's an embarrassment that the United States, which was in the forefront, after all, the Wright brothers were the ones responsible for making the first successful flight, and the United States was in the forefront of a variety of different aspects of aviation in terms of research should be so far behind in terms of commercial aviation? Why was it that in Europe it was a common thing for people to board planes and actually as passengers and go from country to country? And why was it that Germany was establishing a foothold in South America through its airline industry, while the United States, in its own backyard, was paying no attention to what was going on? What was it that needed to be done to wake the United States up? Well, Dwight Morrow, who was a partner in the Morgan firm, was appointed by Calvin Coolidge to do a report for the president. And he came back with reports suggesting that the United States must at least do, if it was not going to subsidize aviation, but what it must at least do is create some sort of framework, that is, the licensing of planes so that you don't allow the old obsolete planes to go flying around killing people and therefore, again, hurting this industry because people had no confidence in it because the planes that we were using were way behind the time. So first, licensing of airlines, of airplanes. Second, licensing those who drove the pilots. Third, setting up weather information. Fourth, airports. And a number of other things like that so that you had at least the basic infrastructure necessary, that is to say the theoretical infrastructure necessary for having airline, for running airline passenger airlines and commercial airlines in the United States. This Morrow report ultimately was approved by the president. It was converted into legislation and, in fact, set the basis for advances in the airline industry alongside the Lindbergh flight. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, of course, is that Morrow ultimately becomes the ambassador to Mexico. Lindbergh goes down to Mexico. Morrow's daughter meets Lindbergh there, and he marries Ann Morrow Lindbergh. Ann Morrow, who becomes Ann Morrow Lindbergh, the daughter of Dwight Morrow.
At the time, when Lindbergh completed the flight and then became this international celebrity, I'm sure that there were people who then saw in him great potential to use him and his image. And, you know, certainly now we're used to the idea of celebrities being used to sell things and to represent points of view and as spokespeople and so forth. Were there people right away who thought, okay, this guy Lindbergh, we need to get him. We need to have him working for us, because having, no matter what it was you were doing, particularly, I guess, if you were thinking about promoting aviation, this is the guy. This is the guy in the entire world that you want to have.
Yeah, there were two sets of people, I mean, two groups that you could kind of create. One is the group that wanted his endorsement for anything, cigarettes, mm-hmm. Watches, pens, motor oil, whatever it was that they could get. Another group that wanted him to star in motion pictures, because any motion picture that he would be a star in would bring in, they thought, millions of dollars. William Randolph Hearst, who made him an offer of $500,000 to star in the film. One of the things that endeared him very much to the people of the United States was that he said, I am not a movie star, I am not a celebrity, I am not going to convert this into cash. He refused the endorsements, he refused all the rest of the stuff. What he did do, though, one of the people who plays an extremely important role in all of this is a man named Harry Guggenheim, whose father made many, many millions through mining ore in Latin America, and who founded, ultimately, the Guggenheim Foundation. Harry Guggenheim was a big fan of flight, and he wanted to help his father make a difference in this world, and what they decided upon in 1926 was that the place where they can make a huge difference is by getting behind the now developing airline and aviation industry here in the United States, by supporting it and by supporting advances in that industry, by providing subsidies and grants that they would be able to make up the difference between the United States and what was going on in Europe. What Guggenheim realized when Lindbergh came back was that there was nothing as powerful as Lindbergh and his Spirit of St. Louis ship in terms of capturing the imagination of the American people. And so what gives Lindbergh's flight resonance is that soon afterwards, he's hired by the Guggenheim Foundation through the advice of Guggenheim and Morrow, and Morrow was on the board of the Guggenheim Foundation, to become the face of American aviation. What Guggenheim did was to give him $50,000 to not accept any of the other endorsements or anything else, but instead to do what it is that he wanted to do in the first place, which is to help build American aviation. And he sent him for a trip for several months around the country. He went to every state, landed his plane in every state, gave talks, and it was estimated that as many as 40 to 50 million people either saw or heard him in this Guggenheim tour. The tour took place within a couple of months of his flight to Paris, and what it did was a number of things. First, it created an airport building mania in the United States. Enormous numbers of people signed up for flights, for training. A number of people, thousands of people, in fact, would later enter the airline industry, but a number of them leave us quotes in which they say the flight turned them around. It made them aware of this new industry, and they were going to make this their own future. And what it also did was to make Lindbergh cement his celebrity, because it was not unusual for people to do unusual things and to be famous for a couple of hours or for a couple of weeks. But what this did, in addition to several other flights that Lindbergh would take, was to convert what was essentially a stunt into something that became something far more, which is to make him into the face of American aviation. Mm.
We are talking in this hour with Thomas Kessner. He is Distinguished Professor of History at the City University of New York Graduate Center and the author of the book The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation, and it is published by the Oxford University Press. And we have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of the show. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You also can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm interested, you know, we talked about here maybe some big ways. Certainly he was important in the developing of American aviation. I'm also interested in, you know, were there small ways that he maybe changed American popular culture? Or for example, the one thing that I think about is the fact that apparently it is said that because he wore a wristwatch, which hadn't been that common to that point, that then after that he helped popularize that as a fashion for men, and maybe that was the death of the pocket watch that previously all men, that's the way they carried their watches, and somehow the idea of wearing it on your wrist was not manly, but because Lindbergh wore a wristwatch, then suddenly it was okay for men to have that kind of a timepiece, and that was that. Were there other maybe small but interesting impacts that he had on American popular culture?
That's very interesting. I think the largest impact is just the fact of his celebrity and what was made of it. But it was an impact in a number of different ways. I mean, if you take a look at the New York Times, which reported on Mondays about various sermons that were given on Sunday at various different churches, it becomes very interesting. He became a model that parents, preachers, and others used to hold up to the youth of the United States. The idea that the United States was going to hell in a handbasket and that its young were dissolute and just doing all kinds of things that their parents were not happy with. And here comes Lindbergh, who didn't drink, who didn't date, didn't carouse, who was careful about his reputation, handsome as could be, and as straight as one could expect, and he had this enormous impact. He became, in various different polls that were done of youth and then of their parents, he became the single most popular person, not only in terms of celebrity, but also in terms of the people wanting to set up models of character. And in that regard, I think it was extremely important. They named all kinds of places in the United States after him. Interestingly enough, in light of the question that your caller asked, TWA, which originally was TAT, transplanted, a different name, but TWA would call itself the Lindbergh Line. He worked for them. He helped develop TAT, which became TWA. In 1938, they took that tagline off. A beacon, which was called Lindbergh Tower, lost its name also. Many of the things that we today may no longer know as Lindbergh influenced, various airports were called Lindbergh airports, streets were named after him. He lost that, or at least they lost those names as a result of controversy when he became someone who was identified with Nazism in America First.
Mm. Let's take another call here. We have someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that he might have had Asperger's, and I'm curious, maybe you already talked about this, but was there any indication that he enjoyed his celebrity, or did he not like it?
Well, there is strong indication that he did not like it. He did not like his celebrity. He was not comfortable among people. He was as much a loner as could be. Later in his life, Anne, his wife, never knew when he would just pick up and leave. He would come home after a flight. This is after World War II. Stay for a short while and then just pick himself up and leave. In fact, he one of the things that came out in the last 7-8 years is that he had two other families in Germany. He had a mistress with whom he had three children. He had another mistress who was the sister of this one. These are many things that are very different from the way Lindbergh was in his youth, but he hated celebrity. He hated to be in the public eye.
Just follow up. How did he deal with all the attention?
Poorly. As I had said before, he turned against the idea of this kind of free society. He resented it. It was interesting that a number of different newsreels catch him looking sullenly at crowds that break through the barriers, sometimes refusing to shake hands with a little child, or just being offended by the notion of his private space being intruded upon.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Other questions? Again, welcome. We might have time to get somebody in real quick. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I guess I suppose I shouldn't be surprised, but I guess I'm a little bit surprised to think about the fact that Lindbergh actually lived into the early 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
When he passed away, he was only 72, so wasn't terribly old. I just sort of have this feeling that certainly in the post-war period that he just wasn't much of a public figure at all. Was in that latter couple of decades of his life, how did he spend that time?
I think it's interesting to look at Lindbergh as a life in three acts, but the third act, that is to say the act after World War II, was one in which he was first shunned for a period of time. 1954, though, he published his biography. He'd been working on it for more than 20 years, this new version of his biography, and when he published it, it became a bestseller, and he won Pulitzer Prize for it. It brought him back into public view. President Eisenhower, previously, he had been stripped of his commission in the U.S. Army by President Roosevelt. President Eisenhower reinstated him, and gave him a generalship. And toward the end of his life, Lindbergh came to a very different way of looking at what he had done. He ended up his life living alone overseas in primitive societies, in the Philippines, in Africa, saying that he wasn't sure that the technical advances that the United States was responsible for were ultimately for the good. Mm. He saw more beauty, he said, in a bird than in an airplane. He tried to live like a tribesman and ultimately was buried in Hawaii in a primitive ceremony. Which in many ways fulfilled a vision that he tried to work out after the war in a book that is called Autobiography of Values, where, I mean, he's not good at it. He's not a philosopher, and he's not a serious thinker. But he was so disturbed by what had happened with the airplane, this thing that he had committed his life to, and the dropping of bombs and what it had done to society and all the negative, what had happened to this wonderful tool that he thought would bring tremendous calm, peace, and tremendous benefits to society, what had happened to it, it left him very pessimistic about technological advance. Mm.
I just have about a minute. I find myself again going back to his, you know, his early life, his personality. He clearly was somebody when he was young was fascinated by machines and also with flying. And somebody like that at that time, you'd think, well, they would be wanting to push the envelope, and maybe not surprising that this thing, the transatlantic flight, which people had tried and failed, it was one of the big challenges. So you would not be surprised that he would want it to try it and see if he can do it. And yet at the same time, I keep coming back to this question of why. You know, what was it he was after? You know, why did he want to do that? And certainly fame was apparently not part of the deal. That was not what he was interested in.
Mm. Well, he had no idea what fame meant. Part of it was he did want a certain amount of fame. He wanted to make his impression on the aviation industry. He had no idea that this was going to be a worldwide event. What he did want to do was to kind of win his mark among flyers so that he would move to the next level. He'd been only a flyer for the airmail, and now he wanted a good position. He would win $25,000, which was the prize. And he thought that this would do one of the things that he did accomplish, and that is to push American aviation to an entirely new level.
Yeah. Well, there we'll have to leave it. It's a very interesting story, and people want to read more about Lindbergh and about the flight. Look for the book, The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation, by our guest Thomas Kestner. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Thomas Kestner is Distinguished Professor of History at the City University of New York Graduate Center. And Professor Kestner, thank you very much.
Thank you, David. It was very pleasant.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website. Anytime that you're ready to listen, just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign, also offering a variety of tea and chai, open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713. Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. U.S. wheat has leapt 5%, posting its biggest gain since climbing 8% on August 5th, spurred by expectations of a sharp rise in grain imports from drought-hit Russia and U.S. weekly wheat exports at a fresh 34-month high. Next, net export sales of U.S. Corn last week were the largest in nearly 16 years, while wheat sales were up that 34%. Let's go ahead out to the marketplace and look at the particulars. And as we do, we see in Kansas City, September wheat is now trading at 714.5, up 29.5. December, 724.5, up 24.5. March, 733.5, up 21.75. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is at 684, up 28. December, 717, up 28.25. March, 739.5, up 29.75. September corn, 417.75, down 3/4. December, 432.75, down 1/2. March, 448.25, up 2.25. May, 455, up 2.25. July, 457.25, down 1.5. September soybeans, 1043, up 7.75. November, 1019.75, down 11. January, 1029.5, down 8. March, 1040.25, down 10. May, 1032.5, down 7.25. September soybean meal at 305.40 is down $2. September soybean oil, 39.78, is down 108. August live cattle, 98.55, up 135. August feeders, 114.15, up 45. October lean hogs, 77.70, down 37.5. Looking at meteorologist Drew Lerner's